Hiya, thanks for having me. I live not far from here actually, so it's nice to come up to Cambridge and talk to people here who are interested in digital humanities and outreach. My background, I've been involved in the arts and humanities, but also computing and engineering science over the past few years, and I do operate on that juncture between arts and humanities, but pulling in technologies from comp sci and from eng sci back in to try and apply them in areas in the humanities. In particular, I've worked a lot on digitisation projects and making things available online and then seeing, and then what happens? But what I'm going to do today is talk about three very different projects which we've been working in at UCL, which have started to involve the public when we've been doing research. And this is almost accidental that we seem to be working on this, but it has become quite a large focus for UCL Centre for Digital Humanities to work on projects which are outward facing rather than working with scholars and trying to do stuff on an individual level. So I'm going to talk about three things: transcribing, curator and textile, and to think about the different ways in which we can use technology relatively easily to reach out to a wider audience, the successes and issues that this has, but also the institutional context at UCL, which makes it easy for us to do that, and some of the factors which have led to us working in this area. So firstly, you probably know more about this than I do. What is engagement? It is an umbrella term that encompasses many kinds of activity. Is that helpful? I'm not absolutely sure. Including science festivals, of course, a lot of public engagement started with the sciences trying to explain what they do, but it's becoming more and more important for people in the arts and humanities to reach out to a wider audience as possible. Perhaps a more helpful definition is that from the National Coordinating Centre for Public Engagement, who say that public engagement brings research and higher education institutions together with the public and it generates mutual benefit. That's what we are interested in, generating mutual benefit. How can we use technology to reach out to a wider audience to A, allow us to do things faster, B, understand how audiences work, and C, build things which are better, faster, more. That's what we're interested in. Using technology, reaching out to people, getting more done at the end of the day. So the three projects I'm talking about are all based at UCL. UCL is an institution that's not even 200 years old, but it is one of the top universities in the UK and in the world. It is very research intensive. It is right in the centre of London. We have a lot of contacts with, British Museum, British Library, just down the road from us. So we're right in the hub of Bloomsbury. And there's a certain chutzpah at UCL, which is, let's have a go. There's a certain energy about the place which encourages a lot of this research to happen. And in particular, it is summed up by this gentleman. I don't know if you've ever met him. He's Jeremy Bentham, and we have his head in a box in the archives. I am going to show you quite a few pictures of dead things in this talk. And this is Jeremy. His head smells like beef jerky. Not very many people get to see him. Quite a character. He was a philosopher and a jurist. He is responsible for quite a lot of legal thinking to do with the setting up of America. He's helped stop transportation of convicts to Australia. He was one of the first people to write about women's rights. He was one of the first people to write about animal rights. He really was a phenomenal character in the 18th and 19th centuries. He's perhaps most famous for his work on the Panopticon, which is a jail where all the people in the prison would be watched by the jailers, which then influenced things like 1984 and Big Brother, things like that. But he worked on so many different areas that very many people are interested in his writings. He's not the founder of UCL, but he did influence those who founded UCL, which Jeremy didn't believe in God, didn't believe in organised religion, and UCL is founded on the tenet that religion has no place at a place of learning, so we don't have a theology department, we don't have a place of worship on campus, all that kind of thing. So he's a big character for us. He sits in the hall at UCL, he has a wee box, he gets shut up at night, and put up in the morning, and there's an apocryphal story that once a year he gets wheeled into the meetings and people say in the minutes that he's present but not voting. So we're very, very proud of Jeremy. We also have, in special collections, we have 60,000 folios of his handwriting. There is also another 20 or 30,000 folios at the British Library, so he wrote a lot of stuff 40,000 of those were untranscribed, so we didn't know what he said. They're sitting in special collections. People have been trying to read his stuff for about 50 or 60 years. The Bentham Project has been set up at UCL, and they've been publishing and collected volumes of his work. I didn't check how long you want me to talk for, actually. It's about an hour, is that right? I can go faster or slower, same way. I just needed to know internal clock what I'm doing. Okay. So there have been 26 of these big volumes published, but that took 50 years to do it. 50 years to transcribe 20,000 bits of paper. We have another 60,000 bits of paper that need transcribed. Can we speed up this process? There was a previous grant which catalogued the boxes to say, this box is kind of about the transportation to Australia, this box is kind of about animal welfare, but really no one had gone through all the documentation to see what was done. So they called me in to one of these meetings about how they wanted to speed up the process, and they also wanted to digitise all the manuscripts. And I said, you're never going to get money to digitise the manuscripts. Now, 10 or 15 years ago, people were writing huge cheques for people to digitise stuff and put it online. Nowadays, no, that funding stream has completely dried up. But what we could do, this was the same week that meeting was held where the MP's expenses scandal had broken in the UK. Remember, MPs buying duck houses, all that kind of thing with their money. And what the Guardian newspaper did was they got hold of the PDF of all the receipts that the MPs had, and they put it online, this massive document of about 250,000 pages, and they asked their readership to sort through it and to transcribe what was on there and to flag up if there's anything illegal. And within the first 80 hours, 20,000 volunteers had read 170,000 pages. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could try something like this with historical manuscripts? If we digitised these and put them online, could we ask the general public to help us transcribe them? And bear in mind that I'm in information studies, and this is all about information, so yay, research for me, I can write about all this stuff. The worst case scenario would be we would get the manuscripts digitised, and that's what we wanted in the first place. Best case scenario, we would also get the manuscripts transcribed. So win-win all round, and I get to publish some research. I give some talk about it, how nice. So here we are, we're digitising the manuscripts. This is Tony Slade, who's head of our media services. And we got these boxes and he digitised them all, and then we plugged them into a system, the Transcribe Bentham Transcription Desk. And it might look familiar on first glance, that's because it's based on Wikimedia, so anyone who's looked at Wikipedia, it's the same layout. We've just taken the free available code and plugged in that stuff there. So anyone who's used to navigating Wikipedia can navigate this very easily because we're basing it on the same type of system. This was a choice. Some people have gone, oh, I can't believe you based it on Wikipedia. It was a one-year project. We had 1 year to digitise the stuff, put it up, develop a transcription desk, then test it and write about it. So by the time we got funding and appointed someone, we had 12 weeks to implement this. And so we used it, and it works fine. We tailored it in some ways, so when you get a manuscript, you can type in here what you think the manuscript says. You can zoom in, this box, you put it over and it zooms in to the manuscript so you see different things about it. And you'll notice along the top here there's a row of buttons, and that is something that we would call TEI XML. Anyone who's in digital humanities will know immediately what that means, and if you don't worry about it. But it's the best practice guidelines when you're transcribing documentary material so that if it goes into a database, other people can deal with it and search it and find it. And we just kind of snuck it in there, like, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it properly. We're going to ask the general public to transcribe using their best practice guidelines in transcription. And let's see if they can take it. So, not only are we giving them a hard thing to do, here's a 2,000 word document, can you transcribe it? And some of his handwriting, as he gets older, I mean, really, it's really pretty difficult. We're also saying, and here are some buttons, and transcribe it using this technique, which some people spend a whole year learning, and we're kind of slipping it in there. Would that work? Yes, it did, which was partly this bit was a complete surprise to us, actually, that people would engage with this and actually do it properly. Come on. There we go. So here's the system, what it looks like when you've actually typed something in. You have the typing in, and all of these brackets, that's when you're putting in the code to say line breaks or additions, deletions, names, dates, that kind of thing. So we can then put that information into our database. So we found some interesting things doing this. This is an account of when he first meets his fiancée, and he kind of meets this woman, and they're having a huge argument, and he goes, that's the woman for me. They never got married because his dad didn't like her. But so we actually found the kind of the account of the first time that he actually meets her, and they have a huge argument. And so that was nice for the historians to find that. My favourite is this transcription, which is describes why he got interested in animal rights. So no one knew really where that had come from. And this is a story of when he was 4 or 5, I've got a bigger thing here, when I was about 4 or 5 years old, when one evening I took it into my head to amuse myself with putting earwigs in the candle. I had no malice to the earwigs, for my disgust at them, if I had conceived any, would have led me to have avoided them, but the writhing of their bodies, added to the little explosions made by the moisture of their juices, composed a scene which amused me. A servant asked me what I thought the earwigs must suffer, and what I could have to say for myself. So he's burning earwigs in the candle, his servant goes, come on now, think about that, and he goes, And that's the basis of his wanting then to create a legal framework to protect animals. Which is really interesting, right? And it's this kind of stuff that we're finding which historians and legal historians didn't know about before, like where his ideas came from. He was quite a character, and this kind of stuff comes out of his documents. Recently, we found, in the last week, he wrote lots of recipes, and it's all about how to deal with entrails and how long potatoes must be boiled for. And it's really fascinating to see that, you know, he's talking about, you know, women's rights and animal rights, and then he's worried about how long you must boil potatoes and kind of writing it down as well. So we're thinking about putting together a little Bentham cookbook. That's the latest thing, because all these things we just didn't know were there, right? And it's because we're having this volume of people digging through stuff. So this is how it works. We put up a manuscript, and it's transcribed by a volunteer. Then they press a button to say, I think I've done it, and it gets submitted. Then we have a moderator, so we have someone employed to read the transcriptions to make sure that quality control is maintained. So this is costly, because then we're paying for someone beside, behind the scenes to moderate all this stuff. He sees, is the transcript of the required standard? If it is, then he locks it down, it gets removed from the list of other things that people can try, and it gets put into our library database, so other people can search for that and find it. If it isn't, it gets thrown back into the pool for transcription, and then other people can help and reread it. So there's a process of looking at these things and throwing it back into the pool. And it's essential that we have someone moderating all this to get the quality of the transcripts which are coming through. And this is our library catalogue then. When any of the ones are actually read, you can search for it in our library and bring up any of this, plus the images, plus the full transcriptions, so you can actually see these things. So it's really opening up these documents to other scholars who are interested in Bentham studies in the first place. There we go. So how's progress? Steady, which is nice. This shows the complete manuscripts which have been worked on, and all the ones which are, the blue line is the ones which have been completed, the red one is the number of manuscripts that have been worked on. So there's always a 100 or so manuscripts which have been worked on at once, and then they get locked down and more come into play. We haven't had that many people sign up, actually. I thought when we started this that we wanted to find 1 million people each to do one page, or, you know, 100,000 people each to do one page. Actually, and I'll go and discuss this a little bit further, what we really wanted was 15 people who are absolutely obsessed and come back and do it every day. So we've already had over 1,000 people sign up. There's a massive spike here. This was when the New York Times published an article about us, and we got so many people signing up. Unfortunately, the New York Times, they didn't tell us they were going to publish an article. It was fantastic that they did. They published it on Boxing Day. So we had over 1,000 people sign up on Boxing Day, willing to contribute. But UCL shut down over Christmas, so none of us were checking our email. So we did get a huge amount of people signing up then, but so many people wanted to sign up and wanted some input and some advice. There was no one there behind the project scenes to answer that email for a week and a half, or you say we shut down, and we lost that opportunity to engage with the club, which was just, and it's an interesting juxtaposition then of, you think, oh, I completely live online, right? Everything's online, it's all fantastic, but actually getting publicity in a print media actually led us to find lots more people, but we lost the benefit of that because we were all drunk at home. Do you know, it's that, to be honest. So it's interesting the timing of how things still work out. So some facts and figures. There have been over 5,000, this is as of last week, there were over 5,000 manuscripts transcribed. 5,000 manuscripts, that doesn't sound too much, but if you remind yourself that it took 50 years to do 20,000, and we've done 5,000 in 2 years, and that's over 2.5 million words have been transcribed by volunteer labour in the past 2 years. 94% of the documents that have been transcribed are locked down. There are only 2,300 registers and counts, but only 350 of those have actually transcribed the full document. Most people come in, have a look at it and go, this is harder than we thought, and then leave. So actually, it's quite a small cohort of people who are coming. We have had spam attacks, but not that many, actually. There's been 418 spam accounts and only a few malicious attacks, actually. It's been mostly people trying to get on there and sell diet pills and stuff. But we have had a lot of visits, 180 different countries people have come from, a lot of page views. People do come back, so people tend to come and then come again and come again to see what's going on. So it's really interesting for us to see how worldwide the interest in this project has actually been, and this is good. We're working in an environment now where we have to prove impact, we have to prove engagement, and we can say, yes, we are allowing people to engage in this, and it's all over the world people are coming to do this stuff. The majority of the work has been done by 15 people. Jay Fox has worked on 24% of the documents himself. What's 24% of 2.5 million words? A lot. That's in the past year. He was relatively late to the table. And there's a leaderboard of people transcribing this stuff, and he was climbing up the leaderboard, and everyone else is going, but you're the newbie! How dare you? So he's at the top of the leaderboard just now. Diane Folan has done just underneath that, 24%, and Lee Stern has done 18%. So we have three super transcribers, and then another 12 people who have done about between 1% and 8% of the total. And these are the people that we wanted to find when we set that up. We didn't know that. We thought we wanted 100,000 people to come and do this. Actually, we wanted to find these people. And we are now doing a study about them and why these people are interested in contributing their time, because most of them are doing this on a daily basis. Most of them are coming on in the evening after dinner and transcribing a document. Diane Folan said that she has her dinner and then she comes and sits down, and rather than watching a soap opera, she transcribes a document now. Isn't that great? You know? But these are the people we wanted to find. These are the intelligent, engaged people who now can read Bentham's handwriting, who now understand our system, who now understand the code. So the work that they do, because they're using the system a lot, is very good. It takes us seconds to check their work when it comes in, and the whole thing is speeded up. There's been an average of 40 manuscripts worked on each week, but that's increased over the past year to 45 manuscripts each week. So we can now start to do a cost comparison on, we employ someone full-time to moderate all this stuff. He could not read 45 manuscripts a week on himself. He could not do that. He could maybe read 20 manuscripts a week if he was transcribing it and making it all fine, if he was doing it on his own. So we're doubling the productivity of the project through doing this. And there was a cost set up where we had to pay for the infrastructure, but now we're in that nice phase of it is ticking along quite nicely, and we're just having to pay the people cost to keep it going. So it is more economical now to do that. The average time taken to moderate a transcript is 6 minutes, but it would take Tim hours to do each one on his own if he wasn't doing that. And this is a graph to show that most people that sign up don't read anything, and it's only a few people, less than 0.1% of people that do the high numbers. But these are the people we're trying to capture, the people that are obsessed and are coming back to help us out. And we've reached a worldwide audience. Isn't that amazing? From all over the world, people coming. Mostly the UK, mostly the States, but all over, Australia, Ukraine, people are coming and transcribing Bentham documents. And this is something we didn't really think about, how it was increasing the interest in Bentham studies and increasing the interest in Jeremy Bentham himself. And an additional thing is, because all the stuff we've developed is open source, anybody else who wants to use the software, to, if they've got a body of documents that need transcribed, we can just give them the box and go, yeah, you just need to change the logo and plug in your documents, and away you go. So the Public Record Office of Victoria are currently using our system to transcribe their documents. And it's we've just been given another quite a large grant by the Mellon Fund to increase this over the next couple of years and make this easier. If anyone else wants to use this, we can help people set this up and plug in your images of your scripts and away you go, try and get people engaged to actually transcribe them. Another thing we didn't really consider was the impact that this would have institutionally, that we were kind of making Bentham a little bit more famous while we were doing this because of the spread and because we've had so much publicity and so much coverage. College have invested more infrastructure in Bentham himself, which means he's had new lights fit. We've also got a nice digital touchscreen in place now so people can learn more about him. Before it was just a leaflet beside him, but UCLDH have then put in a nice touchscreen about Jeremy Bentham so people can actually find out more about him, which is nice. They have a picture of his head. And he's been redigitized. And we really think that this project has kind of put Bentham under the spotlight, which is nice. It's been nice to kind of see the institutional effect it has. One of the things we're going to be doing soon, we're actually putting a webcam in Jeremy Bentham's box so we can see who comes to visit him. And we're going to call it the Panopticam. See what I did there? And it's going to like watch the people that are watching him, but also means that we can count the number of visitors he gets, which we don't know. So there's kind of a playful element to all this too, but at the same time it's increasing publicity for UCL, but also impact and outreach and encouraging people to get more involved in the scholarship of the project. So it's been great to work with Jeremy. I crashed his digitization section, so it's been really great to work with him. I've really enjoyed that a lot. So, from one lot of dead things to another, here's another project that we're working on at UCLDH. This is the Grant Museum of Zoology at UCL. It is a Victorian Museum of Comparative Anatomy, which means it has thousands of skeletons and things in pickle jars. It's fascinating. It got voted recently one of the best museums in London. It is slightly bigger than this room, but double size, like the second floor open. Fascinating. If you're ever in London, don't go to the Natural History Museum when it's half term. Take your kids here. It's pretty empty and it's fascinating. It's got dinosaurs and it's got elephants and tigers and stuff. You know, kids love it. And we were asked if there was anything we could do to increase people's engagement with this. And one of my PhD students, actually, Claire Ross, had the idea that what would happen if we built a system that allowed people to interact more with the exhibits, not only on site, but also through Facebook group, through Twitter, discussions online, and see if we can encourage people to debate, because there's a lot of ethical questions about this kind of stuff. When you have a monkey's brain in a pickle jar, there are ethical questions about, you know, how you display it and how you look after it and what it means to have all these remains. So what we did is we put a series of iPads in the gallery in front of exhibits, and then we asked a really intelligent question of the user, of the visitor, and they can then input their answer when they're there to discuss with the curators, but also they can also discuss online or via Twitter as well. So to try and get some engagement about some of the things in the museum. So here we have it. This is the curator website, and we have the iPads in place. It also worked using QR codes, which were like the big thing a couple of years ago, where you could scan them in on your phone and it takes you to a web page. No one uses them, eh? A, no one uses them. B, they're ugly as. This is technology that was invented in 1982, and it looks like it, quite frankly. So it's called Curator because it was based on QR codes, but actually we're dropping that whole part of the system because no one looks at it. How many people know what that is? Put your hands up if you do. Only about half of the audience, right? There's a whole learning curve to explain to people why they'd want to take out their phone and scan that in and do anything with it, so killing that part of the project. But we built an app which has some questions. So this one is finding a cure for the common cold more important than protecting Tasmanian devils from a contagious cancer which could see them extinct in 20 years. That's in front of our Tasmanian devil. We're then asking people to discuss the ethics of, you know, sending money and things like that. The responses we get from that, and we've had a lot of responses, are really fascinating. Like, you know, you get a lot of noise. Freaky, but so amazing. That's not so helpful. but then you have other stuff about people saying human cold hasn't been cured in the history of man so far. Supply-based valuable resources trying to solve a puzzle that's unsolvable. People are actually engaging with this and actually giving quite intelligent debate back and forth. We can then analyse that. And the interesting thing about that is then we learn more about the museum because we learn more about what visitors think about the museum, and that then feeds into curatorial practice about the kind of things they should be showing people and not showing people. So it's a kind of win-win. We're learning more about the visitors, but also the museum itself can make informed decisions. Because previous to this, all that there has been are museum visitor books. How many people here have ever signed a museum visitor book? Yeah, and it generally is, this place is great, you know? It's not like, I think you shouldn't exhibit this, I think you should be spending more money on this, and, you know, it's not that kind of thing. So we're increasing the way that people can talk to the actual museum. 17% of the comments that we got back were pure noise. So they're like, oh my god, this is so cool, or, you know, your mum, or whatever. 42% of the comments were about the museum itself. Oh, I love this museum, it's so fantastic. Or, why don't you have more things about X? But 41% of the comments were actually on the topic of the question. So there's quite a rich body there of comments. We can understand what people's perceptions are of anatomy museums, and it's interesting, so we can get into the thought process of why someone's coming to visit, what they're expecting from it, and how they're actually engaging with it. And the comments about the museum are interesting as well, because we learnt from that what the most popular exhibits in the museum are, which we didn't know before, and I'll come back to that in a second. This is just to show that there wasn't any real discrepancy across which questions were answered and not, so we have this kind of everyone's kind of answering the same amount of questions. It wasn't like some iPads were ignored, but it did depend where they are around the museum. The first iPad that people come to, they go, what's that? The second one they go, I've seen that before, I'll have a go. And it's how people kind of see things in context and go around the museum and actually engage with it. And then we have a graph about people contributing and people not contributing. About 15 to 20% of people visitors to the museum engaged with this, which you go, that's not huge, but actually that's quite a lot. People come in and write in comments. There are discrepancies in that. When the big bulge is when there was this is school holidays here, many more and more school kids come in July, August, and we get fewer people actually engaging in that. It's more kind of serious when it's here again. We see in this school holiday more people engaged, so we're trying to tease out why people are engaging and why people aren't engaging, and there's no kind of clear cut answers to this. But we're getting responses from about 15% of the visitors to the museum, where before they didn't get any responses from any visitors, so actually it's quite useful for us. And from this we have discovered what is popular in the museum. The most popular exhibit in the Grant Museum of Zoology is the Glass Jar of Moles. Everybody loves the Glass Jar of Moles. No one knows why. It is a glass jar which is full of moles. They have no record of who collected it or why there is a glass jar of moles. Everyone loves it. So much so that the Glass Jar of Moles now has its own Twitter account, and you can talk to the Glass Jar of Moles. And it isn't humorous, but this is the kind of thing I was saying about UCR and having a little bit of humour about it as well. Like, yeah, you know, why not? Why wouldn't you talk to the Glass Jar of Moles? And, you know, he tweets about things and things that are coming up in the museum, and but also just about what it is like to be a glass jar of moles. So it's quite funny. And just recently, we have then been rolling this out elsewhere. So this was an install on site. We won quite a major prize for our curator. It won the Innovation Prize at the Museums and Heritage Award. It was like the Oscar for the museums. And we won that last year. And so recently we've been installing it elsewhere. We have just put it into the Museum of Brands, which is a museum in the centre of London, which we haven't had any affiliation before. This is a private museum, it's paid to go into, so it's interesting for us to see how different it is for a public museum that's free to get into versus a museum where people are paying to get into it, and it's about brands and packaging, as you would expect, and questions such as, what does brand mean to you? What do you think about sustainability when you do your shopping? that kind of thing, and we're looking at how what institutional effect it will have on the Museum of Brands, the quality of comments that we'll get back on these things, and how people are interacting with it. This project also directly links into a project we were approached to get involved with at the Imperial War Museums. So the same type of system went into the Imperial War Museums. It isn't branded as curator because we do go back and re-script a lot of the code, but they embedded QR codes, but also scan and share, they call it, on their system. So there's an app where you can search all of their collection and you can leave comments on it and you can engage with visitors there. So we have the same system, very similar, on site at the Imperial War Museum in London and also Imperial War Museum North. So this is showing how, you know, a university department can then go out and kind of develop something in-house, which then leads to other institutions getting the same kind of thing and engaging with a wider audience. And again, we can then analyse all the comments that come back in, understand the visitor body more. There's much, much more noise in the Imperial War Museum because they have so much, many more school groups. So it's interesting to see the difference in the comments that are made, but it's good to capture visitor experience and understand how we can best explain this stuff to people as well. So that's Curator. So these are two projects which we have, Transcribentum and Curator, two projects which we have built, we have rolled out, they have been successful, yay! And now we're going to talk about something which isn't out yet. We hope it to be out in the next month, but it's going to have been out in the next month for about a year. So we're in the final stages of testing at the moment. And we decided, this is the same team behind Curator, we decided wouldn't it be nice if we could actually make an iPhone app? Because very, very few universities have been involved in this. Very, very few people in digital humanities have made an iPhone app that actually does something. And we thought it would be fun to actually make something and to start engaging with people on a much wider basis. So we are going to be releasing text analysis app. Does anyone know what text analysis is? Probably not. It's something we teach as fundamentals of digital humanities. So if you have a text, lots of words, you can reorder those words. Say you can reorder all the words of the text into alphabetical order, and you can count how many words there are. So if you got, say, Obama's inaugural speech, you could quickly have a look to see which is the most common word he uses, and that would show you something about the text. Also, you could compare that to any other president's inaugural speeches and see how they differ, because you've seen, well, Obama uses this noun a lot, but no one else uses that noun, or, you know, Obama talks about this, but no one else does that. So it's about reordering the text and seeing the statistics underneath it in an easy and friendly way. To do this has been a bit clunky in the past. And we wondered if we produced something on the phone, which with one click could re-visualise the words in a text, would people use it? Or would people actually be interested in seeing it? So imagine if you were at a conference called DEHPHDIE, which I was, and that was the hashtag. And if you're on Twitter and you go, actually, with one click, show me all the words that people talk about. We're talking about on Twitter there. What is the most common thing? The most common thing is the hashtag, but you can see that it's digital, it's at Galway, it's about Digital Humanities Institute, and there are other things that come up about semantic management, social. So you can immediately see the kind of things that people are talking about. So that was with one click we could do that. But the interesting thing, because word clouds have been around for a long time, the interesting thing about Textil is then you click the words and you can get the statistics behind this word has been used this many times in the document, it has this many, the most common word to precede it and the most common word after it, so you can get some input onto the types of words which are actually used. So I'm going to walk you through now how Textil actually works. So here we have it, Textil here on your iPhone. You click that and you hit welcome to Textil. You can either create your own one or you can browse ones which all other people have created. So if you're going to create one, you can enter the title of what you're going to do, but you can choose your text source and the things that you can put in a URL, so you can put on any website, or you can select a book. It comes preloaded with the top 100 books on Project Gutenberg on your phone, and it updates every night as to what your most popular one is. Or you can hook it up to social media, you can hook it up to tweet streams, or you can copy and paste in your own text. And then you go, yeah, so here I'm going to select The Prince by Machiavelli, and then you go, yay, create me a text. And here it is. Here's The Prince by Machiavelli as a word cloud, so you can already see the things. And then when you click on the word prince, it tells you the word prince appears 217 times in this document, and the collocation shows you every single time that it appears in the document, so you can quite easily see and have a look at all the different nouns and verbs. So people use this all the time when they do studies of, you know, Shakespeare, looking at Hamlet. Bring me up every time the ghost comes in. The ghost only appears like 15 times in Hamlet, or is mentioned 15 times. You know, click, there you go. Look at all the things, you know, so you can use it to navigate the text much more easily. And we will also be able to generate stats and frequencies, the full list of stuff, and you can share it on Facebook, you can share it on Twitter, you can drop it into your academic articles when you're writing your thing about Hamlet and the ghost, you know, that kind of thing. And you can browse what other people have been doing, and then there's a website where whenever you make something on your phone, it immediately makes on the website, and you can see it. The interesting thing for us in this is that no one really understands how people have been using text analysis before. And it's a technique that we've been teaching, and a technique that people have used for. But we think if we make this publicly available, it's going to be a free app, only for iPhone just now, and I'll come back to that in a second, means that we'll be able to understand how people are using this and for what tests, because we own the server farm for this. This is all server generated, so we have a huge rack of computers at UCL that we can do what we like, and it will be serving up all the data for this. It's a free app, but what happens when you're using free stuff like Twitter or Facebook or anything else, you sell yourself, right, to be able to use it. So we will be storing, every time anyone else uses this, we store the data. So we will be able to look at what are people in London doing with Textall, because it's all geolocated, because we know where people's phones have connected to the servers from. We will be able to compare and contrast how people in the States are using it versus how people in Europe, or how people in London versus people in Edinburgh, and we'll be able to have to study how text is actually used. Now that is dependent on how many people actually use it. If 100 people use it, we won't get any stats, but if it does take off. And who knows, right? We're really at the stage now, we're translating the interface into various languages before launch. We've just put the first lot into beta testing. It has taken a year and a half to make this. It is a part-time PhD student who's doing the programmer, and Minnie and a designer who are working on it. It's a very small team on top of our day jobs and in kind of the time we've got other stuff going on. So it has taken much longer than we thought. We thought we'd be able to bash it out in about 3 or 4 months. But it has a propensity to be quite a useful tool, and we just don't know. And this goes back to the thing about I'm in information studies, this is information I'll be able to crank out some papers. Hooray! So in some ways it doesn't really matter if it doesn't really fly, because I'll still get some publications out of it about the process of making it and what we actually did. But now I'm in the exciting place of being an academic in my ivory tower who's actually engaging with the real world and trying to get as wide a body of people outside trying to use this and to see how I can engage with that. And I don't know anything about this, right? I'm not trained in publicity, I'm not trained in marketing, but it's going to be interesting to see how we can get this app to as wide a variety of people as possible. Other criticisms we have already had is why only for iPhone? Because, you know, iPhone only has 20% of the smartphone market, and shouldn't we be making it for Android as well as, you know, BlackBerry and all that? To which I answer, we had £7,000 to do this, and the spare time of 3 people. Instagram photograph taking thing was for iPhone only. They raised £2.5 million in venture capitalist funding before they made their Android app, right? So they had a huge heft behind us. This is a small university team making this. If we get an app to market in the first place, yay us. If we get enough people using it, we will find the money somehow, or we will learn how to make an Android version. We don't know how to do that yet. We know how to make the app version. We know how to program for Mac. So it was about the skill set that we had on site. The cost for getting people to build apps at the moment, a programmer that knows Objective-C, salary about £80,000 a year. If you're applying for academic funding for a postdoc, you're capped at about £30,000 a year. So you can't afford to write these people into your grants to come and do this kind of stuff. It's not the kind of thing that you would be funded as an academic to do. So there's a problem there. It was just the fact that we had people on board, on the team, who had the skill set and went, that sounds like fun, I'll do it in the weekends, do you know, or I'll do it when I've got the odd hour here or there. So it's kind of interesting, and I feel it's like kind of new for us as well to be dabbling in this area. So as I said, it's out to beta testing now. We will be then going into alpha testing, which means then we get people that I don't know to have a look at it, and all the people who are looking at it just now I know and I work with. The alpha testing, and then about a month after that we will be launching it. So now we're kind of probably looking at end of May for a public launch. And after that, who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? The average app gets 40,000 downloads, so I'll be pleased if we hit that. But there's a long tail for that. But it could be a lot more, it could be a lot less. And then we're at this really interesting stage of trying to pump out people. So that is Textil. It will be coming soon on the App Store. We are thinking about, if it does take off, having a paid version, which does a lot more and has a lot more tools embedded into it. But it will be very much dependent on the success of this in the first place and whether it's worth our time to actually program it and to make it available. It's been a lot of fun so far. Part of it was, I don't know about you, but I use my smartphone a lot and I wanted to see what it meant to actually make something to work on it. If I'm going to be using this, I'm uncomfortable using technology that's a black box to me. So let's make an iPhone app and let's get it released and let's see what happens. So now we're in that nice stage of, yeah, the development work's also been done. And yay, public engagement. Who knows what's going to happen next? So that's the kind of stuff that we're doing at UCLDH in public engagement. And the interesting thing for this is then we're involving the crowd in our research, whether it's transcribed Bentham, which is to speed up the process of what we need as scholars, whether it's curator, which is we want to understand the crowd so we can tailor the services that we're delivering them from the museum, or whether it's something like Textil, where we can try and create a service for people that we will actually then be able to study them more. And this all comes nicely back into the fact that I am in information studies and it's all about information, and therefore I'll be able to crank out the publications whilst having some fun along the way of doing this stuff, because this stuff has been really enriching and really engaging to try and build stuff to see whether it's going to fly and to take it out onto site and to take it out to places like the Imperial War Museum and to take it out to places like the Museum of Brands and go, yeah, is this going to work? And to take something we build in-house to the Public Record Office of Victoria and go, yeah, you know. And it's been really interesting for us to see our code and our ideas being reused as well as benefiting a lot of people. One of the final points I want to make is that it's not just me that's doing this. All of this is dependent on a fairly large team. So for Transcribe Bentham, we have Philip Schofield, who's the PI on this, and he's a professor in Bentham Studies in Law at UCL, and he's been leading the Bentham Project for over 25 years. So he's really the driving force for this on a kind of intellectual basis. And my role was to come in and just help steer the technology and how the technology was employed. But I'm not a Bentham scholar, you know, scratch the surface on how much I know about Bentham, and there's not that much there because that's not really my interest in it. My interest is in the technology and how we can use it to do something new. But I'm working very closely with people and respecting their knowledge about Bentham and what he's actually doing. We had three postdocs, Tim's the only one who's still with us, Tim Cowser is still with us. We work with University of London Computing Centre, who actually have done the coding, and we're still involved with them for the new Mellon funding, and also the library services so that we can dump everything into the library, and also the UCL design services to do all the digitisation. So this is a huge project really involving a huge lot of people, and these type of projects can't really be done by a small team. It does involve a lot of people to get involved. Curator, I won't go through everybody who's involved in that, except to say that the main driving force behind this has been my PhD student, Claire Ross. Claire is now going into her final year of doing a PhD at Digital Humanities with us. And for a PhD student to have built something which has not only gone into the local museum, but a London museum and a national museum, Imperial War Museums as well, at this stage of her PhD, it's been amazing to see this kind of idea fly. And Steve Gray from CASA has been the programmer behind it. So then working together and then working with a lot of people in public engagement. And it's important to say that this is actually funded by the UCL Public Engagement Unit. So we had, Transcribe Bentham has like £500,000 worth of funding. Curator was £8,000 worth of funding, funded by the Public Engagement Unit. And the amount of success we've had from that small bit of seed funding has been quite amazing. Textil has been funded by a grant from the EPSRC, and that again was about £8,000 worth of funding. So it's just small seed funding, but my advice to anyone who wants to get involved with this is to look at any internal funding that flies around. I don't know about in Cambridge, but at UCL we get these emails all the time about, you know, Provost Strategic Development Fund things up to £6,000. Actually, that's where the fund money comes from. If you can get a small bit of money behind you to do something fun that's a little bit blue sky, that isn't the standard stuff, that's where you get the money to play. So Textil is just the three of us, me, Steve Gray, who also did Curator, who's now doing Textil, and my other PhD student, Rudolf Allan, who's done all the design work for Textil. He does our design work for Centre for Digital Humanities with our nice logo. So we've been working really closely on this. And the final thing I have to say, really, Finn, is I really feel that all this work is actually contingent on me being at UCL. If I wasn't at UCL, I wouldn't have done any of these projects. Firstly, not every university has a dead bloke in a box in the corridor. And it's dependent on having that and being hauled into a meeting about how can we digitise all this stuff and going, no, you know. So it was very much dependent on where I was at the time. Same with Curator, it was dependent on having a museum on board that wanted to be on board, but also that kind of spirit of what would happen if we bolted these iPads to your display cases and see what happened and then going, yeah, we're up for it. Same with the Bender stuff. What would happen if we put a webcam into Jeremy's box? Yeah, we're up for it. So it's about being able to persuade people to join in and play, really. And with Textil as well, it's dependent on people having enough time or enough the skill set to be able to do that. And all of these things are embedded within what is supported at UCL as appropriate academic behaviour, and there is much more input now onto public engagement and to getting involved and to trying to do stuff which integrates us both into London and both into the wider general public in the first place as well. So it kind of fits into UCL's grand challenge at the moment, which is nice. It's nice for me to be positioning myself in my institution doing the kind of thing that the institution wants to do, but at the same time you've got to watch not be steered by institutional things, but it's a product of the institution and it's a fantastic place to kind of be dabbling in all this stuff. It did take me being at UCL for about 10 years before I knew enough people to start stringing things together, but, you know, it's very, very interesting. So that's what I have to say about the public engagement work that we've been doing at UCL. It's been a really rewarding experience kind of going into this area, and I understand that a lot of you are not in the technology side of things, so I would be really interested to hear any comments that you had or any questions about what this actually means for public engagement. Thanks very much. Thank you.